Before we get into today's episode, let me hit you with a quick book recommendation. If you like war correspondents like Ernie Pyle, then check out Richard Tregaskis, Reporting Under Fire from Guadalcanal to Vietnam by Ray E. Boomhauer. In the late summer of 1942, more than 10,000 members of the 1st Marine Division held a tenuous toehold on the Pacific island of Guadalcanal. As American Marines battled Japanese forces for control of the island, they were joined by a war correspondent, Richard Tregaskis. Tregaskis was one of only two civilian reporters to land and stay with the Marines, and in his notebook he captured the daily and nightly terrors faced by American forces in one of World War II's most legendary battles. If that sounds interesting to you, follow the link in my show notes to buy it today. Oftentimes, history is like a game of Clue. You slowly move along the board, collecting little tidbits of truth. Sometimes the game moves quickly and everything falls into place easily. Other times, however, it takes days, or months, or years. Or in the case of the Hatbox Baby mystery, decades. I won't spoil the ending for you, but here's a hint. It wasn't Colonel Mustard or Miss Scarlet that left Sharon Elliott in the desert on that Christmas Eve night in 1931. My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. After failing to link Sharon Elliott, the Hatbox Baby, to the Folstone Baby case, journalist John D'Ella connected with a woman named Bonnie Belza. Bonnie was in attendance at a conference that D'Ella was guest speaking at. At this conference, he passionately told the audience about Sharon Elliott, her mysterious origins in the Arizona desert, her possible link to an oil tycoon's daughter, how the Folstone Baby mystery felt like a slam dunk but was instead a fumble at the goal line, and about how her story had seemingly reached a dead end. After his presentation, Bonnie approached him and offered to help crack the case with her very particular skill set. Since the 1980s, she had been investigating genealogy. Her curiosity was piqued when she learned of a distant family member who had disappeared in the early 1900s. Though she was a genealogist when she met John D'Ella in 2017, that wasn't what she had set out to do with her life. As D'Ella recalls in his series, she started out as a home economics major at Arizona State University with the intent of becoming a stewardess, which is what flight attendants were called in those days. But she got engaged, which necessitated a change in career paths. At the time, the airlines required flight attendants to be single. So she switched her major to business, which, with engineering, were the only options for anyone who wanted to study computer science. In college, she began working for American Express, handling card services and reservations, which used to be done over the phone. She eventually became a collections agent, which required her to use the technique of skip tracing to track down people with delinquent accounts, measures that appealed to her inner snoop. She rose through the ranks at American Express, helping to usher the company into the computer age, all the while she was using her newfound skills to try the nascent versions of genealogy software. To retiring in 2015, she attended a cruise of the Panama Canal. This cruise was more than just a simple jaunt through the ocean in a big boat. This was a specialty cruise for genealogy enthusiasts, and after joyously sitting through the seminars, she was hooked and would dedicate the rest of her retirement to combining her love of technology, DNA science, and genealogy to help others solve their own family mysteries. It was this passion and expertise that she brought to Sharon Elliott's case. Her timing could not have been better. Sharon's health was deteriorating quickly. Now in her 80s, she was the age that her adoptive mother, Faith Morrow, was when she revealed her deepest secrets. Tragically, though, Sharon had no answers. Not really. She knew of her mysterious origins, but outside of a couple of close calls with closure, she was empty-handed. Concerned about Sharon's health and inspired by the rapidly advancing field of DNA science, John D'Ella and his team of investigators, now including Bonnie Belza, got to work. Bonnie came onto the team in July of 2017, and by November they had some promising new clues. Using highly specialized software and publicly available family tree information, Belza was confident that Sharon's true family were German immigrants that settled in Iowa in the 1850s. And following that suspicion, she was able to narrow her search down to the names Strachbein, Kautz, and Roth. After dedicating their lives to this mystery, the team was getting close. Bonnie Belza had used DNA to track Sharon Elliott's roots to Frieda Strachbein and Walter Kautz Roth. And the evidence looked good. Really good. Historical documents showed that the young couple had married on August 1st, 1931, 4.5 months before Sharon Elliott was born, and that they had another child who was born in 1933. Just as it had throughout the investigation, this answer came with a dozen other questions and implications. If Frieda and Walter Roth were indeed Sharon's parents, then she had a brother that she had never met, a family that she had never imagined. But maybe most puzzling of all, it forces us to wonder how Sharon ended up in the Arizona desert if her family settled all the way up in Iowa. Frieda Strachbein had a challenging childhood. As Ella writes, her mother died when she was 3 months old, and her father, with 6 other children, could not care for a 7th. Her uncle, so the family story goes, took the train to a funeral one day and came home with a baby. By the time she was 12, she would be orphaned again and left to the care of older cousins who lived in a 19th-century farmhouse 30 miles north of Davenport, Iowa. A few years later, she would be working as a servant for a well-to-do family who lived in a mansion on a hill overlooking the Mississippi River. While we don't know how she met Walter Roth, we know that he came from Iowa farm stock as well, growing up near the towns of Buffalo and Bluegrass, about 15 miles south of Davenport. His mother, prim and proper, came from a well-to-do family that owned a prosperous lumber business. His father owned a large farm in the rich bottomland along the Mississippi, and together the men in the family ran a threshing business, helping other farm families at harvest time. The team had plenty of information about this young couple. If Bonnie Belza's research was correct, then these were indeed Sharon's parents. But there was one problem. They only had one child, officially, on record. The team was so close. The only way to get to the bottom of the Hatbox Baby mystery would be to travel to Davenport, Iowa, and interview anyone who knew the Roths. And that's exactly what John DeEla did. But before we wrap up this incredible story, we need to pay the bills. We'll be back in about 90 seconds, so hang tight. You do not want to miss this tangled web that I'm about to unravel for you. While in Davenport, Iowa, John DeEla set about his mission to interview anybody who remembered the Roths. And he was successful. He found their friends, their family, their distant and not-so-distant relatives. And he was able to use this information to understand the couple even better. They were church-attending, card-playing, beer-drinking, well-loved servants of their community. In his later years, Walter became a carpenter for the public school district. Frieda was described as fussy and very careful with her image, and Walter was known for being soft-spoken and hard-working. And while this was nice, there was still one problem. The team had strong DNA and genealogical evidence to securely pin Frieda and Walter Roth as Sharon's parents, but they still didn't have that final nail in the coffin. That piece of hard evidence. That historical record. That is, until they reviewed the evidence that they already had. On the birth certificate of their son James Roth, a small detail sat. Line 27 asks for number of children of this mother at the time of birth and including this child. On the certificate, under A, born alive and now living, the number is 1. Under B, born alive and now dead, the number is also 1. So there it was, proof that Walter and Frieda had another child. But this revelation gives us even more to consider. The paperwork suggested that their previous baby was alive at birth but had died afterward. However, there wasn't a record of a birth, only the implication of one. And though that seemed at first like maybe another brick wall, it was actually the key to a rusty door. Now that there was historical documentation to give the DNA and genealogical evidence credibility, the final step was to figure out how the Roths' secret child ended up in the Arizona desert, and why. Understanding why proved to be much easier than understanding how. If the documentation was correct, then Frieda and Walter would have been pregnant out of wedlock, a particularly consequential social sin at the time. Not only was it looked down upon by society, it was also daunting. In the height of the Great Depression, being a young parent, even one who was lawfully wed, was unimaginably challenging. Abortion was impossible, adoption was difficult, and orphans weren't guaranteed a happy life. In fact, they were almost promised the opposite. So what were families to do? The answer, sadly, were doorstep babies. D'Ella notes that they were children left on the front door of a church or hospital or unsuspecting neighbor, or even abandoned in cornfields. The problem was so common that it seeped into popular culture. Famed journalist Haywood Braun even put together a traveling, touring, musical variety show called Shoot the Works, which featured a song by Irving Berlin called Doorstep Baby. That show played in Davenport the summer of 1931, 2 weeks after Frieda and Walter were wed. The landscape in Iowa was particularly harsh for unwed parents. Unwed mothers who wanted to turn their babies over to an orphanage underwent an almost ritual public shaming before their children were accepted. And newspaper story after newspaper story details prosecutions of unwed fathers. Given this harsh climate, it's easy to see why the Roths might feel that abandoning their baby would be the best option. But the question still remains, how did Sharon get to Arizona? The first clue was hiding in the young couple's wedding announcement. Miss Frieda Strackbine, daughter of Mr. George Strackbine of Sioux City, Iowa, formerly of Loudoun, became the bride of Mr. Walter Roth, son of Mr. and Mrs. Edward M. Roth of Bluegrass at 2:30 p.m. today at the parsonage of the South Park Presbyterian Church, Rock Island. The Reverend W. G. Ogilvie performed the ceremony, and the attendants were Mr. and Mrs. Floyd Benshoof of Davenport, brother-in-law and sister of the bridegroom. The bride wore a gown of pale pink chiffon taffeta, made with a tight bodice having cap sleeves and a long flaring skirt. Her flowers were pink rosebuds and baby breath. Mrs. Benshoof's gown was of green organdy made in princess lines. Following the ceremony, a wedding dinner was served in Loudoun at the home of the bride's uncle and aunt, Mr. and Mrs. Henry Strackbine. Covers were laid for 15 immediate relatives. Sunday evening, the couple will be honored at a dinner given by the bridegroom's parents at their home. Covers will be laid for 25, and the table appointments will be in pink and white. The bridal couple will leave on an extended motor trip to Sioux City and to Western Points, after which they will reside in Davenport. The bride received her education in the Loudoun schools. Mr. Roth attended the Scott County schools and is engaged in farming with his father and brother. Certainly, Arizona could be considered parts west of Iowa, but how could we be sure? Truthfully, we can't be. Though John D'Ella and his team pieced together a very solid case, we can't quite parse out all of the details. But I believe they've left us with an outline of the events that is very convincing. Frieda Strackbine and Walter Roth were young and in love. When Frida became pregnant out of wedlock, they realized they had a very difficult road ahead of them. They couldn't let anybody know about the pregnancy because they would be publicly ridiculed and ostracized. They also couldn't keep the baby because they felt the crushing jaws of the Great Depression pressing down on them. They did the only thing they could think to do. They got married as planned and skipped town for their honeymoon. They visited Walter's family and then set out for Arizona, where Walter's cousin George Washington Cotts happened to be recovering from tuberculosis. His recovery was taking place at Fort Whipple in Prescott, where Faith Stieg was working as a typist, and where his niece, Lily, a maternity nurse, was working as well. Perhaps Faith and Lily talked about how badly Faith wanted a baby. After all, she had divorced a man that she once loved because he wouldn't give her a child. Maybe it came up in conversation, and then maybe Lily overheard her uncle, George Washington Cotts, talking about the dire situation of the newlywed Roths. And maybe, just maybe, Lily connected the dots and offered a solution for everyone's problems. The Roths could give their baby to a well-off and desperate family. It would certainly be better than leaving it on the doorstep of a fire station or church, and the Stiegs could get the one thing that they wanted most without the hassle of traditional adoption, which was very difficult and stigmatized. The only trouble was getting the baby to Arizona. The Roths' honeymoon provided the perfect cover for this mission. It was such a good cover that they even mentioned it in their wedding announcement. They skipped town, drove to Arizona, and gave the newborn to Ed and Julia Stewart. At the time, Ed Stewart was an ice truck driver who delivered to grocery stores all around the Mesa area, many of which were owned and managed by Henry Stieg. The Stewarts found themselves in a very similar situation to the Roths. They were young, in love, and dealing with the stress of having a child in the middle of the Great Depression. Perhaps Ed was offered a few extra dollars to help the Stiegs out with a very unique task. The Stewarts took the baby to the Mesa police, as instructed. Then, they turned their back on the situation and refused to talk about it ever again. Maybe as a term of a deal struck between Henry Stieg and Ed Stewart, or maybe just because the Stewarts felt guilty about helping in a somewhat shady plot. Either way, once the news broke, the Stiegs stopped everything, including cooking their Christmas turkey to go see the baby. They filed the adoption paperwork and made sure that they were able to be at the hearing, despite the inclement weather keeping the other 198 applicants away. They also contacted a close personal friend, George W.P. Hunt, who just happened to be the governor of Arizona. They asked him to contact Judge E.L. Green and pull some strings for them. Whatever Governor Hunt said to Judge Green clearly worked because the Stiegs were awarded custody of baby Sharon, and the investigation into the case was short and fruitless, with investigators not even following up on the wildly inconsistent testimonies offered by the Stewarts. Perhaps the investigation was so lazy because the judge and a select few higher-ups in Mesa knew what had happened. They knew that in the 1930s, it was easier for a couple to set up an elaborate charade than to adopt. They knew that the state needed a story to rally behind, a distraction from the slow, painful death of the Great Depression. Maybe, just maybe, they knew that they needed a Christmas miracle. Do we know these things for sure? No. Don't get me wrong, we know most of it for sure. But we will never know the small details. Just like many things in life, we take the facts, piece them together, mix in a little bit of suspicion and faith, and form a conclusion. Thank you all so much for listening. Wait, don't stop. Don't turn it off. I've got an announcement that I actually would like you to hear. If you're the kind of person that tunes out before I get to the very, very end, totally fine. Don't blame you at all. However, today, I do have an announcement that you might actually care about. I am bringing Thursday Footnotes back. Fingers crossed that I'm doing it this week. I had to tweak the format just a little bit, but here's the actual big part of the announcement. Thursday Footnotes will be an Apple paid subscription show. I haven't worked out all of the details yet. I don't exactly know how to do that, but I've heard that it's pretty easy. I know that about 90% of you that are listening to this right now are doing so on Apple Podcasts. And so perhaps that might be a successful strategy for helping to move this podcast to bigger and better things in 2022. So I'm going to set that up. I'm hoping to get it done this week because honestly, guys, there is a lot that I skipped over. This could have been a 5-part series if I had just like read John DeLa's work word for word. That's plagiarism, so I did not do that. But honestly, he did the most intense work that I have read so far about a single very obscure topic. So hats off to him. Very, very impressive stuff. As I have with the other two parts, I will link to the articles so that you can check it out and give him the much needed attention that he deserves. I tried to find him on the socials, but I couldn't. I probably could have maybe found like some publicist's email or something to get a hold of him. But honestly, I wanted to talk to him because I was so impressed by his series. If you were impressed by this, by my podcast series, definitely you will like his written series even better because it is 10 parts instead of 3. As always, guys, this show wouldn't be possible without the good people over at Indie Drop-In Network and Earbuds Podcast Collective. Both of those services will help you find your new second favorite show. I know for sure that on Spotify, this show was 14 people's number one favorites. So if you're one of those people, send me a screenshot of your Spotify Wrapped, and I will send you a gift. How does that sound? I'll send you something fun from the merch store. 14 of you out there qualify for that fun reward. If that's one of you, please get a hold of me. I would love to acknowledge the fact that you listened to this show more than any other show on Spotify for the year. That's very cool and is honestly very humbling. Also, something that's cool and humbling, this show has grown a lot in the last 2 weeks. I think that's due to a lot of things, one of which being Greg at Indie Drop-In featuring one of my episodes on his true crime show, and the other being Ariel Nissenblatt of Earbuds Podcast Collective, writing in an episode of this show for the Bellow Collective Outstanding 100 list. Again, guys, I promote them every week because they deserve it. They are two amazing people that help this show out a ton. As always, there will be links to everything in my show notes. I've got to go try to figure out exactly what I'm doing tomorrow with my life, and also how to get Thursday Footnotes back on track because I enjoy doing them, and I've got a lot of things to say about this series. So I've got work to do. I've got to get this thing uploaded. You guys have a nice week. Hopefully, I'll hear from you on Thursday. Or you'll hear from me. I'm not sure which way this one-way street goes. Take care.